To you, a new member to me, a new fellowship, and I know that she has wonderful things to say to us about her experience in Al-Anon. I understand she's involved in service work in Florida. She may tell us a little bit about that, but when I asked her about herself, she told me the most important thing. I said, how long have you been in Al-Anon? And she said, 24 hours, and I said, yeah, that's how long I've been into. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Roberta from Florida. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Roberta Verda, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. And I love that, all that welcome and all that love coming to me. I really appreciate it. I had no idea I was going to be in West Virginia in July. And my higher power has me here, and I'm real grateful for that. And I want to thank the committee for inviting me, and the wonderful welcome, and the hugs, and the fruit basket, and just everything. It has been so special. And Jackson's Mill is just gorgeous. There is so much peace and serenity here, and I have just really been in touch with my higher power and just being here. I need to tell you that I just didn't decide to come to Al-Anon one day. There's a lot of things that happened on my trip here. I grew up in northern Minnesota, and I grew up in the family disease of alcoholism. Only I didn't know that was any kind of a problem. Everybody drank in my family, and they always drank for a reason. If it was sunny, we would celebrate the sun, and if it was raining, well, people had to drink for that reason, and if somebody got a new job, that was a celebration, and if somebody lost a job, that was time to, drink, and if there was a birth in the family, or a marriage, or a funeral, or, there was always a reason to drink, and I grew up in a family with two younger brothers and my grandfather. And I remember my grandfather sending me to the store with a little note and some money to buy beer. Now, he was an old man, probably 60 at least, and everybody knows that old people have a hard time walking. And, the store was about a block away, and so it was real hard for him to walk down to the store, so he used to send me, and I would buy the beer, and he would let me keep a penny or two of the change and get some bubble gum or something like that. I remember my father used to go out and have so much fun, and I remember that because sometimes he got to stay out all night long. And I remember him coming home and not being able to walk up the stairs. And I didn't know what that was all about. But I would be getting up in the morning and he couldn't walk up the stairs. And today I know what that was all about. And I grew up in the family and I had two younger brothers and there was always a lot of chaos. There was always something going on. There was always a tragedy, there was a party, there was something going on. I mean, there was a lot of excitement and a lot of turmoil. And I tried to be a good little girl as best I could. I remember going to school in the first grade. And we did spelling words in the first grade. And at the end of the year, I brought my little book home that had all of my spelling words for the whole year in it. And I got one wrong. I was 6 years old and I got one wrong. Now, I never focused on how many words I spelled right in the first grade, and I'm sure there were many, but I did focus on the fact that I had one wrong. I wasn't perfect. There was something wrong with me. And I tried to fill up that something wrong with me with a lot of activities, a lot of friends, a lot of whatever I could do. Overachieving in school, just trying hard, trying to fit in. And I never really felt like I fit in. I really didn't. There was something something was wrong with me that I knew I wasn't adopted in my family. I mean, I really knew that this was my family, but I never really felt a part of them either. I just never felt a part of, but I kept trying. I really did. And up into high school, I decided what it was that was going to fix me: a boyfriend. I had not had a boyfriend. And all girls that were popular, you know, they had boyfriends and they did things and they went places. And I looked around and there he was. Gorgeous. 6'2", a crew cut, Buddy Holly, horned rim glasses, and a 1950 green Mercury. He had all the right equipment. And I knew that was the answer. That really was. And we started to date, and I'll never forget our very first date. We went to a ball game at the high school. And it was just really exciting because at this time I was a senior in high school and he was a college man. I mean, you talk about status. This was it. And he opened the door to let me into the car and out rolled a bunch of beer cans. Full beer cans. And he threw them back into the car. And you know, really and truly, I was not upset by the fact that there were beer cans. What I was upset was that he couldn't keep them more neatly. And I really saw that there was something for me here, you know. I could organize. And we started to date, and it was wonderful. It really was. We went to ball games and out dancing and just had a wonderful, wonderful time. And he asked me to marry him. And by this time, I had gone to college myself, and he had 2 years left. And I made the logical decision that I would quit school and go to work so that he could finish his last 2 years and then he could support me. And, you know, there was never any thought that, you know, this isn't the way things were in the early 60s, because this is the way things were. I figured if I hadn't had a man or a husband by the time I was a senior in college, I would have wasted all that money. The only reason I was there was to get a man, and hey, I did it after 1 year. I was good. And we married, and he went to school, and I kept thinking, you know, when he's done with school, then my life is going to begin. My life is going to start. Because I was still having those feelings that, you know, something just really isn't right with me. There's something wrong. And after he finished school and got a job, we moved to a town about 150 miles south of where we'd grown up. And it was a big city, and it was going to be wonderful because my life was going to start once we got to St. Paul, Minnesota. And he got a new job and went to work, and I was pregnant with our first child. And you know, I knew my life was going to start any minute, any minute. And after a few years, the second baby came along, and things just really weren't going right. I didn't know what the problem was. I really couldn't tell what the problem was. But he got an offer to move to Macon, Georgia. Oh, how wonderful. We were going to get out of the cold and the snow and move to new country. And Georgia was a gorgeous state, and I just couldn't wait because I knew the minute I got to Georgia, my life was going to start. And we got to Georgia and moved into a little house, and babies were starting to grow up, and the there something wasn't right. I started to notice he was drinking more and more. And I started to make comments. Do you think you should drink so much? Do you think you should drink alone? And he said, oh, well, of course, there's no problem with that. I work hard, you know, I'm stressed. I just shrugged it off. That was, you know, a reasonable explanation. And then he decided he needed an advanced degree to further his profession. And at that point in time, I went back to work again. And it really was a real saving thing for me, because before this time I had been so focused on what he was doing that, you know, it really wasn't healthy for me. So I went back to work, and he went to school and continued working, and I knew that the minute he finished that degree, my life was going to start. And after that degree, he got an offer to move to Lafayette, Indiana. Wonderful. Back to the Midwest. Those good down-home values, family values, you know, this is where I needed to be, back in the Midwest. We moved to Lafayette, Indiana, and I knew my life was going to start. And when we got there, it was a hard, hard time. He was working lots of hours, attending evening meetings, and I, as part of the job, and I figured, well, because he's doing all those evening meetings, he won't drink as much. And the thing is that he found all the time he needed to drink before and after and weekends. So the job really wasn't it. And he worked so hard, and it was such a stressful job. And at this point in time, my health started to fail, and I was having some real serious health problems. And I went to a doctor, and I didn't really have a diagnosis, but he said, you know, is there any stress in your life? And I looked him straight in the eye and said, no. There was no stress in my life. You know, I couldn't tell even a doctor that, you know, there was something wrong, something was going on. I didn't understand it. It was my fault. Shortly after, well, we spent 5 years in Macon and 4 years in Lafayette, Indiana. I went into a depression also at this time, and I was working, and yet it was a time when that's basically all I could do. I got myself to work, and I came home, and I sat in a chair and really was immobile. I couldn't move. I don't know if anyone here has ever had a snuggle sack. It's kind of like a sleeping bag that you can sit in a chair and watch TV or whatever in. Well, I would go to work during the day and go home and sit in my snuggle sack all evening because I just couldn't move because of the depression. Only I didn't know what was wrong. I really and truly didn't know. Shortly after this time, he got an offer to go to Naples, Florida. Oh, hallelujah, there's sunshine. My life is going to start. And we moved to Naples, Florida, and I just knew this was the answer because he wasn't going to have those evening meetings. Therefore, he wouldn't have the stress of the job and wouldn't have to drink so much. Well, he didn't have the stress of the evening meetings, which meant he could come right home after work and start in. And I got to thinking about this. The reason he's drinking so much is that he really doesn't know how much he's drinking. Now, this man has an advanced degree, and if he knew how much he was drinking, surely he wouldn't drink that much. So my first attempt to control the drinking was to buy a set of little sugar glasses. Now, we had never had little shot glasses in our house, and I was sure that, you know, you measure one little glass and then fill it up with ice and mix and all, and, you know, and that's all you drink. He never used those glasses. And the drinking was really, really getting to me. And I decided that, well, if he's not going to measure, maybe I just need to show him how much he's drinking. And at this point in time, he was bringing the liquor home in those great big jugs with the handle on. And so I decided that the best way for him to know how much he was drinking was for me to save all of those empty bottles for 1 month. And I chose January because it has 31 days. And I took the bottles out of the trash. I, you know, rinsed off the coffee grounds and the banana peels. And I took a big black marker and wrote the dates. There was one bottle with January 1st. There was another bottle with January 3rd. Then there was January 4th. And on. And I saved all of these bottles very carefully in a black bag in the garage, because on the 31st I was going to spread them out on the dining room table and just let him know so that he would quit drinking so much. He never cleaned the garage. But January the 15th, he went out and found my stash. And he said, "Why are you saving all these empty bottles?" And now you can't make a point with only 15 days worth of bottles. So I just kind of shrugged and said, "Well, just throw them away. They're, you know, I really didn't need them." And I was sure the drinking was my fault. I wasn't good enough. I wasn't pretty enough. I wasn't a good enough cook. I wasn't a good enough housekeeper. I didn't have a good enough job. I wasn't good enough in the bedroom. I just wasn't good enough. And that's why he was drinking. And as we had made these geographic cures, as I've understood them today, he was always more successful and more successful and you know, was going up in his career. But the progression of the disease after about 5 years in Naples, Florida, they allowed him to resign from his job. They didn't fire him. They allowed him to resign. And he did that. And he immediately got another job. Now, my denial is telling me, alcoholics don't work every day. Alcoholics live under the bridge. They don't have families. They beat their wives. He never laid a hand on me. You know, this wasn't the problem. There was something else that was the problem. My denial was, you know, so blind to the disease of alcoholism. After about a year of working at this job at about one-third the salary he had been making, he did get another offer to go to Stuart, Florida. And I knew moving to Stuart, Florida was not going to be the answer. My life was basically over. It wasn't going to begin this time. So we made the move, and it was with a lot of heartache, a lot of despair, because I knew the pattern was going to be repeated, whatever that pattern was. And shortly after we moved to Stuart, my mother was dying of cancer. And she came to live with us for a couple of months. And the alcoholism was so progressive, and I was just totally crazy myself from everything that had been going on. there just was, you know, no hope anymore. It was all despair and gloom. And a few months after my mother died, one day he came over and said, I'm going to go to the doctor. I said, oh, really? Were you having a medical problem? And he said, no. He said, I'm going to go and find out if I can get some help for my drinking. I just about fell over because we had never, ever discussed his drinking. I made the cuts and the digs, you know, aren't you drinking too much? You know, why are you drinking alone? You know, because I really never thought that you had to quit drinking. I mean, you know, drink like normal people, have one or two. I didn't realize that for an alcoholic that's not possible. And he went to the doctor, and the doctor suggested a treatment center. And he went to the treatment center, and I went to family week at the treatment center, and they told me I needed to go to Al-Anon. And I thought, oh, well, I guess so. I need to find out how I'm going to keep him sober when he gets out of the treatment center. And so after about a week or so, I went to my very first Al-Anon meeting. And that's my home group today. It's the Stewart Friday Night Al-Anon Family Group. And it meets in Stewart, Florida at 8 o'clock on Friday night. If you're ever in the neighborhood, please come. And I walked into that meeting with my smile plastered on my face because no one was going to know what was going on at my house. And they said the Serenity Prayer, and I immediately started to cry. And it's a good thing that at that meeting, they take newcomers aside and tell them about Al-Anon. And two long-timers in the program took me aside and started talking to me about Al-Anon. And I really don't remember a word they said. I sat there and just boo-hooed. And I just don't do that easily. I mean, it's the sobbing kind of stuff. But I did hear keep coming back. I did hear that. And they told me to go to lots of meetings and read the literature. And I started to go almost every night of the week to a meeting. And I started to hear the message. Alcoholism is a disease. I didn't cause it. I can't cure it. And I can't control it. And I had tried very desperately to do all of those. And when I heard that it was a disease and that it wasn't my fault, the weight of the world was lifted. It really was. And then they told me to focus on me. What are you talking about? Focus on me? Hadn't a clue what that meant. But I kept coming back and kept coming back. And they gave me a prescription early on. And the prescription was the page in the One Day at a Time book, July 1st. The man I married cannot be the source of my happiness. And they told me I needed to read that four times a day. Morning, noon, evening, and before bed for 10 days in a row, and I would feel better. And I was in such pain and misery at that point in time, I did what they said. I started to read July 1st, four times a day. And I started to understand a little bit about what that page was all about. And I kept coming back, and I kept coming back, and I read the literature, and it was great, and lots of meetings, and they kept talking about a sponsor, but you know, that's for other people. And After about 6 months in the program, I really reached my emotional bottom. I had really come to understand that my problem was me and that I needed to do something about me. And I'd always been so self-sufficient. You know, I can handle anything. I can do anything. I don't need anybody's help. Thank you very much. And for me to take a risk and to reach out and ask someone to be my sponsor was the point at which I started to grow in this program. I could ask for something from me. And she said, yes. And she said, we'll start working the steps now. And we did. And I came to realize how powerless I was, not only over alcohol, but over people, places, and things, and how unmanageable my life had become. And I did come to believe that there was a power greater than myself who could restore me to sanity. And step three was really difficult. Turn my will and my life over to a higher power. And I was in an open AA meeting and listening to someone share about step three and how they approached it. And they told a story of three little frogs sitting on a log. And two of them made a decision to jump off. How many frogs were left? And there were still three frogs. Because two had only made a decision. And for me, I could make that decision to go on with the rest of the steps and do the rest of the program. The fourth step was a beautiful awakening for me because I found out that I wasn't supposed to focus on all my defects of character. I was supposed to focus on what was right and good with me. And up until that point in time, there really hadn't been, or I didn't believe that there was. So if you haven't done the fourth step, get a sponsor and do it. And the fifth step, I mean, it was bad enough to admit things to myself and to God, but to another human being. And the beautiful part about that sponsor was that as I was sharing with her, she shared with me. And you know, she's not perfect. And she told me I didn't even need to have to try to be perfect. And that was part of, you know, what I thought I had to be, is perfect. And after the fifth step, I thought, oh, wow, we're done with this. And she says, no, we've got step six next. Step six, be willing to get rid of these defects? Well, I guess I'm willing, but how do I do it? Step seven, I humbly ask a higher power. It's not going to be in my time, and I don't have to do it alone. I've got a lot of help. Step eight was making a list, and I was able to do that quite easily. But when it came to step nine and making amends, there were a lot of people in my life that were gone. You know, I told you how we moved around so many times. My mother and father were both deceased at the time. There were a lot of people that weren't in my life anymore. But I found that I could make amends to those people that were in my life. And by doing that, it relieved me of the guilt. And it gave me a new place to start. And step 10, I continue to take a personal inventory. And it's not so hard anymore to admit when I'm wrong. In fact, it's kind of good, you know? I'm not perfect. But I'm trying. I'm trying. And step 11 for me is a conscious contact with my higher power. And I thought that God had to be conscious of me. Well, he was always conscious of me. It's just that I wasn't conscious of him. And in step 12, I try to carry this message and practice all these principles. And it's not easy. It really isn't. As you notice, I haven't mentioned my girls that often or that much in my story. And the reason was I was so focused in on my husband that they basically grew up on their own. Family disease of alcoholism is something else. The oldest daughter is a super achiever, lots of education, a wonderful job, and a lot of, you know, real positive things in her life. And in the last couple of months, she's been seeking out Al-Anon. And I'm just so grateful for that. The youngest daughter was still living at home when her father went into the treatment center. And as I said, the older daughter was super achieving. The youngest had 3 F's on her report card and was not going to complete that year in high school. Well, she went to summer school and was able to, you know, pass and did graduate and went on and got a couple of years at the community college near our home. And the disease of alcoholism started showing itself in her life. She'd go out on Friday night and come back on Tuesday. Or, you know, just be gone or, you know, try to avoid the family totally. And it was getting real painful. And she moved out to go to school. And that never really happened for a while. And she came home for visits and I'd find beer in the closet. You know, there were a lot of things that I watched. And I'm so grateful that I was going to Al-Anon because, you know, I could support her and not enable her. And as a mother, I'm sure that I will always enable my children to a certain extent, but I know the difference today. And I know that I don't have to totally carry them and be responsible for their problems. And there's been a big letting go. And the youngest daughter was involved with a sexual assault and the police and a lot of, you know, really tragic things. And my husband and I were on a vacation in North Carolina, and we hadn't been away for a long time. And this was a week together for us, and it was just, you know, going to be a very special time. And I left the phone number where we were going to be. And the second day there, and we're at a mountain lodge with, you know, not even phones in the rooms or anything like that, I got a message that the youngest daughter had tried to commit suicide. And the page that came to my mind from the One Day at a Time book was the one where the woman greeted the minister at the door who was bringing the news. And you know, what do you do when there's bad news and when there's tragedy? You go about the business of living. And I knew my daughter was in safe hands. She was in a hospital. And it wasn't a situation that I could go and rescue her or save her. And the decision was made that, you know, I'm going to stay and finish the week that I had planned at the lodge and then go to see her. And I'm so grateful that I was able to do that, to leave her in God's hands. And in among all of these things that were going on, I became really involved with Al-Anon. My first job with a group was the literature chairperson. And that meant I had to come early and put out all the pamphlets and the books. But I also needed to read everything so that we would know what needed to be ordered and, you know, be able to direct newcomers to the right literature. And I had a wonderful, wonderful introduction into Al-Anon that way. And part of my perfectionism took over too. We had a little literature rack, and I made sure that they were all stacked in the proper size. We never had two red pamphlets side by side. We always, you know, had a blue or a green. Very important to a perfectionist. There was a gratitude dinner that I worked on, and it was our part of the district, and they were looking for people who were grateful to Al-Anon. And Al-Anon had really changed my life a whole lot. You know, I was starting to really feel the serenity. When I went to the meetings in the beginning, that 1 hour sitting in the meeting was the only hour of serenity I had in my life. And after a while, I was able to take that serenity from the meeting in the car on the way home. And eventually, I was able to take that serenity into my home and carry it through the day in my life. And it was beautiful. At this time, the GR for the Stewart Friday Night group moved away out of town. And the group needed a new GR. And nobody was willing. And I said, well, I can't be a GR, but I could be an alternate GR. You see, I'm not good enough to be a GR, but I could be an alternate GR. So I raised my hand that I would be the alternate GR. And I went home and I called my sponsor and I said, Stewart Friday Night has a new alternate GR. And she says, oh, and who is that? And I said, it's me. And she said, and oh, and who is the GR? And I said, well, we don't have one. And she said, and what does the alternate GR do? And the alternate GR takes over when the GR isn't there. So slow. And I started going to the district meetings and really enjoying them. And after I'd done that for a while, there came an election. And they needed a DR, a district representative. And I knew that I couldn't do that. I wasn't good enough. And they went around the room and were asking people, you know. And all of a sudden, my hand went up. And I didn't put my hand up. My higher power put my hand up, and I know that. And I got to be the DR and serve a panel. And it was a beautiful, beautiful experience. Because not only did I have to work my steps, I had to work my traditions and my concepts. And here I thought I was all done with that stuff, you know? And the harder I worked, the better it got for me. There's just no stopping. After a panel as a DR, we were having our big assembly to elect the delegate. And my sponsor kept telling me that, you know, if I provide the availability, God will provide the ability. And that's a hard thing for me to, you know, really grasp and understand. It really is. And they asked those that were eligible for delegate to stand, and of course I could stand. I'd served as a 3-year term as a district representative, and who's willing, and I wasn't willing, and I sat down. And then they said, okay, now it's time for the alternate delegate. And I said, I'll stand up. And as I stood, there were 5 others. And I said, oh, wonderful, because, you know, there will be, you know, votes for all of these other people, and I'll have the least number of votes, and then I'll be able to sit down after the first, you know, little round of this voting. I had the most votes. I couldn't sit down. And it's a beautiful, beautiful journey. In South Florida, the alternate delegate is also the forum coordinator. And the forum has really been my special, special pet in terms of the literature. when I chair a meeting, it's generally what I use to chair a meeting. And my sponsor, of course, was always telling me, you know, to write something and send it in. And, you know, I just couldn't do that because, you know, I couldn't write. I wasn't good enough. And she asked me, "Are you a literary critic?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, it's not going to do any good in your drawer. If you send it to World Service and they need it and can use it, they will. Let them make the decision. Let your higher power make the decision of what's going to be used." And so I wrote a little story at one time and mailed it in. And maybe 2 years later or so, I got my forum in the mail. And I was excited because every time I get it, I read it cover to cover. Then I put it in my purse and take it out and read it page by page, you know, for the rest of the month. So I opened my forum and was thumbing through and looking, and somebody had written in my forum. It was defective. And I looked a little bit closer, and it said, "Roberta, thank you for sharing." And there was the little piece I had sent in 2 years before. I want you to know I really can't write, but that doesn't matter. Somebody thought I could, and somebody could use it, and I'm so grateful for that. And my life in Al-Anon has just really been wonderful. There's been a lot of healing in the family. There's been a lot of communication. There's been a lot of, you know, real positive things. I go to lots of meetings still. I go to conventions when I'm able. I just love this program. And I have so many friends in both the programs, Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful for that today. And I need to tell you that just when I thought I knew my story, God gave me another chapter. About 6 weeks ago, my husband came home and said that he was dying in the marriage and he wanted a divorce and he moved out. And I was totally, totally devastated. And immediately, God's love surrounded me. All of my friends came. And, you know, they were with me with tears and hugs. And it wasn't any kind of that, you know, judgmental, critical kind of thing. But immediately my old tapes started to play. You know, I thought that I was beyond all of this. But right away the old tapes started to play. I can't tell anybody. What will people think of me? What's wrong with me? I woulda, coulda, shoulda, all that stuff. And I'm so grateful for the friends and the love and the support that I've had, because God is doing for me what I cannot do for myself. And I know that today. And you know, the wonderful thing about Al-Anon friends, they don't let you stay in self-pity. They just boost you up and love you and let you cry if you want. And they've shared my tears. And they've shared the meetings. The very first meeting I went to after that news was on fear. And right away I was into big time fear. What is going to happen? And I don't know. I don't know. The second meeting I went to after this was the Wednesday night meeting. It happened to be on the page July 1st. and it was really a message to me from my higher power. Take the prescription again. And I have been. And the meetings have been on gratitude and love and faith and trust and all of those beautiful things that I need right now. And they've all just really spoken to my heart. And without the love and the friends, you know, I wouldn't be here. I really wouldn't. I've had cards, I've had messages on my answering machine. I've had, you know, just such an outpouring of love where I didn't even expect it. I was in the supermarket getting a jug of milk, and all of a sudden, you know, the overwhelming sadness just got to me. And I looked up, and there was a friend from the program with a hug right in the dairy department. God delivers. And another morning, I get up early to work, and the sun hadn't come out yet, and I got in the shower, and there's a window in the shower, and it was just, you know, hardly gray light out, still pretty black, and I was having those really lonesome, isolated, lonely feelings. And I got into the shower, and there's a window there, and all of a sudden I looked at the window, and glomped on the window was a frog. And all of a sudden, I looked a little closer. There was another frog. Now, I've heard about three dog nights, but I didn't know about two frog mornings. And what that did for me was to bring me back to the present, to today, and what I can do today. And I could take my shower and get dressed and go to work and go about the business of living. And that's all my higher power has for me each day, is to go about the business of living. But I do know today that the quality of my life depends on how I live, step one. Because I am powerless. I want to scream and cry and kick and holler that, you know, this isn't fair, this shouldn't be happening, and it's happening. And I'm just so grateful for the love and the program and the support and a higher power. Because I'm not alone today. I'm not alone. Some days I even have two frogs. And I guess the message that I have for myself today, and I don't know if anybody else needs the message, but today is Saturday, and this is Jackson's Mill, West Virginia, and I'm here, and I'm really here, and your love is here. And I can feel that love. And that's what Al-Anon is all about for me. Unconditional love. And I'm so glad that I know, you know, about the disease of alcoholism. Because I can hate someone's actions, but I don't have to hate the person. I can still love the person. And that's important for me to love. Because that's my life. And I really believe that that's why we're here, is to love one another. And for me, that is the Al-Anon message. And you are all messengers for my higher power. And I love you all. And thank you so much for letting me share.